Welcome everyone. This is Beverly Tomasian, and I'm very excited today to be presenting our webcast, New Horizons in the Prevention of Type 1 and Type 2 Diabetes. This topic and information within it is very exciting to me personally because I think there's so much opportunity here to really make a dent in this epidemic of diabetes. And so I love sharing this with my colleagues in my community to increase our awareness of all the different things that are influencing this epidemic of diabetes and some real tangible strategies we might be able to share with our patients and with our communities to help make a dent in this diabetes epidemic. We're going to be talking today about new findings in prevention and treatment. We're going to focus first on type 2 and then switch over to type 1, and we are going to talk in the interim about double diabetes. So we'll try and squeeze a lot of information in there. And if you're thinking about taking the CDE exam in the future, really our company is here to support you. And hundreds of people have joined us in the last few years through our CDE boot camp and our live seminar. And if you go to our CDE success page, it's so great to see just the different people who have taken the exam and passed and the gifts they bring to the community. It's really inspiring. So let's get started with our program. I have your handout was posted, and hopefully you have that available to you, or you can go to our website under the Resources tab, New Horizons, and click the PowerPoint PDF and download it. But the thing about diabetes is that 35% of Americans will be living with diabetes by the year 2050. That's a lot of people living with diabetes. Currently, about 10% of Americans have diabetes, so we're seeing within, 40 years that number will triple. So this is a big concern to all of us because what resources are we going to have to take care of so many people with diabetes? Currently, 35% of our Medicare dollars go to treat diabetes, the complications of diabetes. And during this presentation, I'm going to really be presenting why don't we take some of that money that goes into treating complications and move it over to the prevention side. I think that would be money very well spent. So anytime you have a chance to talk to your congresspeople about any legislation on board for diabetes prevention programs, if you have a moment to email them or say, yes, I support this, it can really make a big difference. There's thousands of diabetes educators throughout the country, and if our voice could be heard, maybe we could get some forward momentum on prevention of diabetes. Well, speaking of prevention, I'd like to launch a poll question, and here it is. Which of the following is true about pre-diabetes? And there's more than one right answer. A, 1 in 5 people have pre-diabetes currently in the U.S. B, 10% of people in the U.S. have pre-diabetes. See, 90% of people with pre-diabetes don't know they have it, or D, 30% of people in the U.S. have pre-diabetes. So there's more than one answer on this one. So I'm going to go ahead and launch it and choose your best answer. While you're looking at that, I wanted to say it's something that it's informative. So how do we define prediabetes? Well, prediabetes is a fasting blood sugar of 100 to 125, or an A1C of 5.7 to 6.4. So we definitely have a definition of prediabetes. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Most of you have voted. And let me show your results. So A, 40% of you said 1 in 5 people have prediabetes. That is wrong. The number is a lot higher. We'll be going over that. B, 10%. Nope, that's not right either. C, 90% of people with prediabetes don't know they have it. That is absolutely right. And D is also correct. 30% of people in the United States have prediabetes. 30%. So I really am in shock about this. 1 in 3 adults in the United States has prediabetes. That's 86 million. And of those 86 million with prediabetes, 90% don't know they have it. So that's where I see a big role on our end is reaching out to people with prediabetes. Because as you know, even when you have prediabetes, fasting 100 to 125, A1C 5.7 to 6.4, your risk of heart attack and stroke is doubled. So we know that it's associated with inflammation and insulin resistance. We want to find people with prediabetes and help them prevent it. As far as diabetes goes, 10% of Americans have diabetes, one quarter don't know they have it. And so we have a real dilemma here as far as finding people who have diabetes and making sure they get early and aggressive treatment, and especially our children. There's the Today study that has looked at the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, and the rates are definitely going up, a sevenfold increase, type 2 in kids since 1990. Who's at highest risk? Very obese, minority females, low socioeconomic status, and limited education. So we definitely know there's an intersection between income and geography and risk of diabetes and obesity. So what they're saying from their studies is that environmental changes are urgently needed. And it doesn't just say education, which is really interesting to me. So lots of people know how to be healthy and how to keep healthy, but their environment doesn't support it. So we think about diabetes as a public health issue, and I really do consider it a public health issue because about 70% of Americans are overweight or obese. Our rates of gestational diabetes are on the rise. So as we see more gestational diabetes, those women are more likely to get diabetes later in life, and their children are more likely to suffer with obesity, insulin resistance, and diabetes. 30% of our kids are overweight or obese. So this is a real call to action. And I love this poster by ChooseHealthLA.com. It doesn't say don't eat junk food. It's just a very simple message. Choose less, weigh less. Portion size matters. And it's a real nice image of how to cut your calories in half. So of course, we would say, well, don't eat junk food, right? That would be the better message. But we need an interim. Eat less food and then move to more healthy food choices. So it's just kind of how are we going to approach this from a public health perspective? So kind of thinking about that, what do you think is contributing to the increasing prevalence of type 2 diabetes? Is it junk food? A, lack of exercise? C, changes in gut bacteria? D, environment? Or E, all of the above? I'm going to go ahead and launch this poll and see what you all think. All right, too easy. Thanks for voting, everybody. I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to close this poll. You all just, most of you voted with such decisiveness. You just said, yes, this is the right answer. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share it with you. So 90% of you chose E, all of the above. And that's what I'm going to say, all of the above. All of these are contributing factors to increasing prevalence of diabetes. We're not always sure how, but we know there's changes in the environment, changes in our gut bacteria that have been associated with increased risk of diabetes and obesity. And let's kind of talk about that some more too. Why should zip code determine life expectancy? Every time I look at this a slide, I get angry because it really talks about health disparities. So this is a kid. If you look at the same child, if they were born in Stockton, and if you don't know where Stockton is, it's in California, and it's a really rough neighborhood. Not a lot of resources. Pretty dangerous to go out. You wouldn't really think about going out and exercising, especially in the evening. You may not come back. So pretty tough neighborhood compared to Irvine. Now, if you grow up in Irvine, lots of resources, very safe, great environment, you might live to 88 years of age. So why should a person born in Stockton not afford the same life expectancy as somebody born in Irvine? That's where the health disparities are coming in. And that's where, as diabetes educators and advocates, we can start saying, hey, this isn't right. Everybody should be having same access to health care and resources and deserve to live the same life and have life expectancy similar throughout America. If you want to look up your zip code, it's so informative. Go to measureofamerica.org and you can see your demographics, the socioeconomic status, and the life expectancy of your zip code area. And kind of thinking on this note, Dr. Frieden, who's in charge of the Center for Disease Control, CDC, he's a real revolutionary thinker. I love reading his papers and his approach to health because he really gets it in a profound way. And he says the only way on a societal basis to reduce the prevalence of obesity is through community action. And so, yes, it's important. As an educator, I talk to patients one-on-one. I'm doing individual interactions with people, but really we need to make changes in our environment and kind of setting up people for success as far as health. So community action really seems to be the way to go. And we do currently live in an obesogenic environment. What does that mean? It is not an environment that supports health. It is an environment that supports obesity. If you go to any liquor store, you will walk in and you will be assaulted by chips, by beverages that are colored and full of sugar, and by candies. That's the first thing you walk into a store and see. And it's not done that way by accident because humans like to eat that stuff. And so how can we think about setting up our environment for health? What if we walked into that same liquor store and we were confronted by vegetables, by whole grains, by foods that are delicious and nourish us? Just putting it out there as a thought. It could happen during our lifetime. So, quick poll number three. How many teaspoons of sugar does the average American consume daily? I'm going to just launch this poll. Is it 6 to 8 teaspoons? Is it about 10 teaspoons a day? Is it 12 to 16? Or is it 22 teaspoons a day? How much does the average American consume in sugar a day? Just talking about an obesogenic environment, you think about where sugar is put into everything. I mean, there's sugar in our cereal, there's, sugar in so many of the foods we eat are just filled with sugar because it makes it more appealing for us. And we don't need all that sugar. So it's not supporting health, that strategy. It's sabotaging health. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. So let me share it with you. 32% of you said 12 to 16 teaspoons a day, which is the wrong answer. 68% of you, 22 teaspoons a day, the right and the shocking answer. 22 teaspoons a day. That's unbelievable. Just to think about it, there has been in several occasions a warning labels on sodas has been proposed. California was trying to get it through, wouldn't go through. The Coke lobby and the beverage lobby is very strong. One soda has 12 teaspoons of sugar. If it's a 20-ounce soda, I believe it's 20 teaspoons of sugar. On average, one person consumes 40 gallons of soda a year, and the American Diabetes Association has come out and said we need to limit this. So the American Diabetes Association, who is a very conservative group, if they are coming out and saying to limit sugar in our food, that's a pretty strong voice. But it's not just the American Diabetes Association. Recently, the World Health Organization has come out and made a statement too. But I just want to give you some facts that might help you because, as educators and advocates, we want little quick facts to help support what we're saying. And according to Harvard researchers, drinking 1 to 2 sugary beverages a day increases a person's risk of type 2 by 26%. Now, Mexico, 70% of their people are overweight or obese, and they felt like this, we need to do something urgently. Mexico has 70% of its people overweight or obese. America has the same numbers. Mexico decided, just so you know, Mexico said January 1st, 2014, they put a sales tax on sugar, sweetened drinks, and junk food, by the way. By doing that, in 3 months, the consumption of sugary drinks fell 10% in 3 months, and people drank more water and milk. Wow, amazing. This is another great fact. Drinking a 20-ounce soda a day was equivalent to an average of 4.6 years of telomere shortening. So telomeres are kind of used as a surrogate measure of our life expectancy. They're found in white blood cells. So UCSF found that when a person drinks sodas, if you look at their telomeres or their life expectancy, it seemed to be shortened by about 4.6 years. So sodas are not a good thing. The World Health Organization is saying we need to reduce, this is a recommendation, free sugar intake. So this is an important differentiation. It's not like fructose found in fruit, or lactose found in milk. It's like white sugar added in or other sugar sources added to food. We need to reduce that to 12 teaspoons. We're at 22 right now, so that's cutting it in half. Ideally, it should only be 5% of the total daily intake, or 6 teaspoons. We're trying to work to 6 teaspoons a day of sugar. And in our hospital recently, I was so proud, they had this thing, try being sugar-free for a week, added sugars. And so maybe we can start getting some momentum around this. And again, the American Diabetes Association is saying sugary beverages associated with increased risk of diabetes, obesity, and perhaps that visceral adiposity that increases insulin resistance. So we have momentum. We have data now to back up the fact that soda is not a good thing. And in Berkeley, they did pass a sugar tax, which was really exciting. And if you don't know about Berkeley, it's in California, a very liberal community. But I was so impressed that it was a lot of work for them. But they did say, we need to tax sodas in our community. Let's reduce the consumption. And if you think about this, if you think about cigarette smoking, when they imposed a cigarette tax in the 1990s, cigarette smoking dropped dramatically. People, when they have to pay more, usually consume less. Here's the exciting news. If you think about prevention of diabetes, which is really what I'm trying to talk about today, so I'm looking at environmental factors that influence rates of diabetes and obesity. But we do know by making these changes, by drinking one less soda a day, by eating less, processed foods, that can lead to weight loss. And every 2.2 pounds of weight loss reduces the risk of diabetes by 13%. This is shocking. It's not 10 pounds, it's not 5% of the body weight, it's 2.2 pounds. So every pound we can help our communities lose helps reduce the risk of diabetes. In one community, you know how they help their people lose weight? They just mandated that restaurants make their plate size smaller, that the restaurants can only serve food in 9-inch plates, not the huge plates. The community lost weight. So there's little things that can make a big difference. So we're talking now about environmental factors, and let's kind of move into type 2 diabetes. Now, why are we seeing this increase, this epidemic of type 2 in American, actually, all countries that are eating more westernized type of food and becoming more industrialized? And I would just like to suggest today, because we always say, well, it's because we're eating more and we're not as active. But there's more to it than that. And so part of this webinar today is to look beyond the obvious. What are some things that could be influencing these rates of diabetes that don't usually come to mind? Because there's some interesting things happening to humans and to our animal friends. And this is an original article published in Newsweek by Sharon Begley. And Sharon Begley is a health writer. She's really amazing. Her knowledge and understanding of health is profound and impressive. But she wrote a great article, 2010, that kind of got me started on this whole topic. And she goes, not only are humans gaining weight globally, animals are getting heavier too. Well, sure, our domestic animals are getting heavier, but not just the domestic kinds, animals out in the wilderness, like macaws and marmosets, they're getting heavier too. What could this be? Is it sleep deprivation? Now you think about that. We used to have a situation in the universe where at night, when the sun went down, the world was dark, but then we invented electricity. And so it is so rare now for there to be complete darkness. There's a lot of, as you know, light pollution. And so maybe because of this extended period of light, we're not sleeping enough. The animals aren't either. What about air conditioning? That doesn't obviously affect animals. to maintain our temperature when it's too hot or too cold requires a lot of energy expenditure. So if we're always in environments that are comfortable, we don't burn up those extra calories to maintain our body temperature. And is there some other factors like the environment and the foods that we eat? Are there changes in the environmental food chain that is increasing our body weight? Something that we hadn't really suspected before. And so before I move on to the gut bacteria, I do want to mention something else. We're noticing that humans are getting heavier. So a lot of humans are getting diabetes type 2, but they're also manifesting this thing called double diabetes. And I want to talk about double diabetes in the next slide, but before I launch into that, I want to launch a poll. Maybe you've never heard of double diabetes, but what would you think it means? What best describes double diabetes? Is it type 1 plus type 2? Is it gestational plus type 2? Is it steroid-induced hyperglycemia plus type 2? Or is it type 2 on insulin therapy? What do you think double diabetes means? This is kind of a new term that's starting to enter the literature. Mostly in Europe, I've seen it more discussed, but some American articles are talking about it. But I want to share it with you because I see it in my own practice. Okay, thanks for voting. Most of you have voted. I'm going to close this poll. Thank you, and share it with you. So 65% of you actually did choose the right answer, type 1 plus type 2 diabetes. Is that possible? Can a person with type 1 diabetes also get type 2? Well, let's find out. So I actually, in my own experience, my own practice, I had a gal come in to see me. She weighed over 250 pounds, and she had type 1 diabetes, and it was well documented type 1 diabetes, but her insulin needs were so high, and this was a few years back. Her insulin needs were so high for a person with type 1 diabetes. And then I started asking her, does anybody in your family have type 2 diabetes? Well, she goes, both of my parents have type 2 diabetes. And I was like, really? And so then I was talking to my colleagues about this patient. She has type 1 and she seems to have type 2. And they were like, oh yeah, we have a lot of patients like that with double diabetes. And I'm like, you do? So I started researching it. And sure enough, there it presents in the literature talking about people who are born with or not born, but who express autoimmune type 1 diabetes, maybe at puberty or so, something like that. And then as they move into adulthood, into their 40s, they gain weight and they become insulin resistant. And if you ask them, they will say, oh yeah, I have a strong family history of type 2. So these patients are manifesting complete insulin deficiency, autoimmunity of type 1, but also type 2 diabetes because of their genetics and their increased body weight. And so then you think, what do I do? How do I manage somebody with type 1 and type 2? That's a great question. We don't have good data to support how to do this. But there is a trial I'm going to show you in a minute where they're looking at people who are type 1 and obese or overweight and adding to their regimen metformin because they're thinking they're type 1 and type 2. They're manifesting insulin deficiency and insulin resistance. But I do want to point out something. In the research, when I was doing the research for this, they also were encountering kids who are overweight, who developed type 2 diabetes, who later they were on oral medications for type 2, like metformin, but then their blood sugars went really high a few years later, and then they checked their autoimmunity. They also had now type 1. And they're thinking maybe these kids who are overweight with type 2 who later express autoimmune type 1, they're just stressing out their pancreas. And so I'm not saying like type 1 turns to type 2. That's not what I'm saying at all. Or type 2 becomes type 1. I'm saying there's manifestations of both. Double diabetes in adults, type 1, add on type 2. There is a study going on, as I mentioned, called the Removal Study. It's going on in many countries, but not America, with adding metformin to insulin therapy to see if they can reduce insulin resistance. Also, I do want to mention for some of our type 1s, there's a small handful of studies going on where they are adding different medications to the insulin to see if they can't reduce insulin dose and improve blood sugars. In one study, they looked at adding Victoza to people with type 1 diabetes. Now, as you know, Victoza is only indicated for type 2s. It's a GLP-1 agonist that is a gut hormone imitator. And anyways, in this study, it helped lower weight and insulin dose and improved A1C. Also, with type 1s, they are adding in some small studies SGLT2 inhibitors like Invokana, Farxiga, Jardiance, to those on type 1 and insulin to see if that doesn't improve blood sugars. And so on the page, the resource page I've listed for you, I've listed some of the studies that are looking at this. You can click on the links. I do want to say one thing about SGLT2 inhibitors. There is an FDA warning out that says SGLT2 inhibitors can increase risk of diabetic ketoacidosis, and I'll tell you why. Is that sometimes if a person's on insulin plus the SGLT2, they might decrease their insulin too much, and so then they're insulin deprived. Even though their blood sugars might look okay, they're still not getting enough insulin, so they're burning fat for fuel and leading to ketoacidosis. So SGLT2s are not approved, FDA approved for type 1s, but some type 1s are using them. So just kind of be on the lookout for patients on these SGLT2 inhibitors. Let them know the signs of ketoacidosis and really make sure they keep taking adequate amounts of insulin. This is especially true during illness. It's really important. Okay, let me see. Somebody has a question. I'm probably... Yeah, somebody was mentioning that Victoza, they've reformulated Victoza, which is a GLP-1 agonist, and they're calling it Saxenda, and it was approved for weight loss therapy. So that's kind of a whole different topic, but we know that those GLP-1s really do help people with not only losing weight, but also getting their blood sugars down. Okay, let's move on to bacteria. So gut bacteria and body bacteria, the really exciting thing is the Human Microbiome Project. So we finished the Genome Project, which mapped our entire genetic map, which is so amazing. They're still trying to figure out what to do with all that data. Now they're moving on to the bacteria on our body. I don't know if this is going to happen during our lifetime because there's 30 trillion human cells, but we host 100 trillion. That's even like hard to imagine. On our body right now, there's 100 trillion bacterial and fungal cells. So we have what I would call bacterial and fungal hitchhikers on us, in us, surrounding us, part of us. And we have the symbiotic relationship. So bacterial cells outnumber human cells 10 to 1. And I'm going to tell you something. They're all fighting for real estate on our bodies and in our intestines. They all want to survive and proliferate. So they're going to encourage us, their host, to do certain activities to support their health and their growth, which is kind of interesting to think about. We'll get more into that in a minute. So getting to the gut, we're going to talk about gut bacteria and its relationship to our body health and weight. And then we'll look at gut bacteria, their influence on expression of type 1 and type 2. And we're going to take a look at gut hormones. So here's our intestines over a mile long. And we're really considering them to be an endocrine organ. They have so much, that intestinal tube has a lot of influence on our overall health and our immune system and our body weight and expression of disease. Well, speaking of bacteria in our intestine, how much do your gut bacteria weigh? Let me launch a poll. Do they weigh 24 ounces? Do they weigh 6 pounds? Do they weigh less than 1 pound? D, 1.5 pounds? Or E, I'm really not sure how much my gut bacteria weigh. It's probably not something you usually talk about. Yeah, we're carrying around a lot of bacteria in our intestines. Okay. I could see you all are voting and kind of changing your vote. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share this very exciting answer with you. Originally, when I did this talk last year, it was 4 pounds. But now new research has shown us that we carry 6 pounds of gut bacteria. They're hitchhikers on our intestines. They're intestinal hitchhikers. And actually, they're pretty awesome. So I just wanted to show you there's over 10,000 species of gut bacteria in your intestines right now. Here's an electron micrograph of the small intestine and the bacterial inhabitants in green. Wow. You know what? If you want to learn more about this, Nature, the journal, does a ton of articles on gut flora, gut bacteria, microbiome, I mean, really interesting information. So intestinal health is really a balancing act. And when we talk about the major phyla or inhabitants of our intestines, we usually divide into two groups, the Bacteroides and the Firmicutes. Now, the Bacteroides are primarily responsible for protein and carb breakdown, and the Firmicutes are responsible for absorption of fat. Now, the ratio of Bacteroides to Firmicutes has changed over time. And what we're seeing that is there's a ratio of Firmicutes has gone up over time. Now, what does that mean? And so as we go into this part of my lecture, I want to say that this is unknown territory. And as I read a lot of articles about this because I'm very intrigued by it. Many times there's conflicting information. So I'm going to go through these slides and you're going to be like, well, this doesn't always seem to match up. It doesn't, because we're still in exploration. And so I would just say the following to you. Diversity is the most important. Diversity of gut bacteria is the most important. And this relationship between Bacteroides and Firmicutes seems to be very important too. When these get out of balance, what we see is increased rates of disease. So we're not sure if the bacteria are initiating disease or if the bacteria reflect disease happening in our body and their ratios change. So we're not sure if it's a causative relationship or just a finding that informs us that things are out of balance. I hope that made sense. So we are still trying to figure this out. We're just trying to figure out all the inhabitants in our intestines, let alone what they do. But I think this is a really interesting part here. Where do we get our gut microbiome? And we are considering your gut microbiome an endocrine axis. What does that mean? Well, it's an endocrine organ. It's releasing chemicals into our bloodstream that affect our health and our response to our body. But this gut microbiome is really stabilized by 3 years of age. And I want to tell you some really important factors that if we're birthed vaginally, or if a person is vaginally delivered, they have a healthier gut microbiome than a person has a C-section. So we know that if you want to look at intestinal health over a lifetime, vaginal delivery is better. We also know that breastfeeding. So these are the two most important factors for the first few years of life. Try and be vaginally born if you can. And also breastfeeding is really important. Breastfeeding really does populate your gut with the best variety of bacteria, especially the bifidobacterium. Really important for intestinal health over a lifetime. It's also influenced by antibiotics. So there's some really good research coming out that children who are exposed to antibiotics, especially early in life, it really can disrupt their microbiome through until adulthood. So we use a lot of antibiotics, and is that contributing to our shifting of our microbiome? And what about the food we eat that has been treated with antibiotics? Is that causing problems? You see, these are questions we don't have answers to, but we're understanding better and appreciating more the role of the gut bacteria in our intestines. What about the environment? We're going to talk about this more, but are we eating foods that have been sprayed with, fungicides or other chemicals that are killing bacteria that are normally healthy for us? And are we even getting outside and interacting with our environment? And what about travel? And also, do we go to preschool or are we home and are we homeschooled? So sending kids out into the world and getting exposed to other kids and other foods informs the gut bacteria too. So the gut bacteria, we are kind of stabilized by 3 years of age. They're influenced over time, of course, but we really want to help people have the best gut microbiome early on in life and to maintain that as much as they can. Because these bacteria and yeast help utilize energy and fight off invaders. So let's talk about this a little bit more. There are 6 pounds of microbes in our gut. And this came from Endocrine Today, this little slide that I put together. Endocrine Today in April, and I'll reference that on your resources, had a real nice write-up on this. But we can think of this community of bacteria as an extra organ. I never thought of it that way, which we can call the microbiome. We have evolved together with our microbiome for millions of years. This didn't start, 10 years ago. And so this tenuous symbiotic relationship has developed over, time and has worked well for us. And I would say, starting in the 19, whenever antibiotics right around that time were developed, we might start seeing the shift in the relationship of our microbiome and our intestines. It's changed over the past 30 years. So maybe by the foods we're eating, it's changing too. The change in our microbiome mirrors global spikes in obesity, diabetes, allergic and inflammatory diseases. So we've certainly seen an increased risk in autoimmune diseases, allergic situations, many more allergies, asthma. And so as the gut bacteria change, so do our risk of different diseases. What are we doing to change these bacteria? We talked about antibiotic therapy, especially early in life. Early in life, giving antibiotics can change fat metabolism. Not just for that duration when you're on the antibiotics, but for life. And what about the foods we're eating? So again, more questions than answers, but I do want to talk about something really interesting. And this is a Type 1 Diabetes Prediction and Prevention Program, or DIP. This is an American study, but also in Finland, they found the same thing, because Finland has a lot of diabetes, and they're doing a lot of work on prevention of Type 1 diabetes. So it was launched in 1994 to search for means to prevent or delay type 1. So it follows these studies, follow a core cohort of children at genetic risk for type 1. So if one of your parents has type 1, they're going to look at the genetics of that child and the autoimmune expression, and they're going to see follow these children over time. And as they follow the children over time, some children do convert over to type 1 and some children do not. That they look at their stool samples. This is so interesting. They decided to look at the kids' stool samples and see was there any change in the bacteria for those kids who converted to type 1. And they found that right before conversion of type 1, there was a sudden drop in bacterial diversity in their stool sample. There was an increase in certain species of Bacteroides associated with a 20-fold increase in risk of autoimmunity. But what they want to caution here is association is not causation. It's not that the Bacteroides is causing autoimmunity. Maybe the shift in the Bacteroides is due to something happening in the body, and that's causing a shift of the bacteria. So we don't know, but we certainly know looking at stools and looking at the bacteria in the stool give us a lot of insights into the health of the host. And the humans are the host, right? So, it's fascinating information. Let's keep going. What about weight, body weight, and gut bacteria? New and early research. Fecal samples in humans have distinct microbial signatures. If you're obese, you have a certain array of gut bacteria. If you have type 1 versus type 2, you can look at somebody's stools bacteria and kind of identify where they are on the continuum of body weight and disease. Isn't that interesting? So we can look to see if there's more pathobiont. So these are normally healthy bacteria, but under certain dietary conditions, they bloom and become negative forces in your intestines. What happens is that there's these lipopolysaccharide endotoxins that are released with high-fat diets that cause inflammation in the intestines and leakage, causing inflammation in the bloodstream. Obesity is also associated in this study. This was a great article by Megan Jardine in Endocrine Today. But they looked at the stools and they found that if the person's obese, they have higher levels of Firmicutes and Staphylococcus aureus. And there's depletion of the good guys. So, pretty consistently in research, when I've been reading through this, there's two good guys who always stand out in your intestines, the Bifidobacterium and a lactobacillus. And you'll notice in a lot of the probiotics, they contain the bifidobacterium and lactobacillus because those are the good guys that we know signal health, and they really help promote intestinal health and body health. This is this really interesting bullet point I have here. Microbes might strategically generate cravings for food. Really? So listen to this. If you eat a lot of junk food or a person eats a lot of junk food, you're going to grow a certain type of bacteria. So those bacteria may in turn send signals to the brain to tell the brain, hey, get me more junk food, get me more junk food, right? Or if you eat a lot of sugary foods, then a certain type of bacteria grows. Because see, the bacteria in your intestines are always fighting for real estate. They want to grow, they want to proliferate, they want to take over and dominate. And so they're going to tell your brain, hey, brain, you need some more sugary foods, go get some more, because they want to grow and proliferate. So you can imagine this new research coming out that we're stimulated to eat certain foods to support the bacteria in our intestines. Interesting. We do know, though, that a high-fat diet, low-fiber diet decreases microbial diversity. That's one thing we do know for sure. Let's keep going. Which two best describe our relationship to gut bacteria? Well, I think I've answered that, but let's go ahead and launch this anyways. Which of the two answers, there's two right answers, is what this is trying to say. Less is better, more diverse is better. Foods rich in fiber improve gut bacteria flora. Limit intake of bacteria to improve health, or all of the above. I'm just reading your questions. You guys are funny. Let's see. Oh. Okay, I'll answer those questions. I might have to keep going and then answer your questions at the end, but I'll see if I can answer your questions as I go through. Okay, most of you have voted. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it. So you all are on fire. 74% of you said, yeah, more diverse is better. And 69 said, foods rich in fiber improve gut bacteria. B and C are right answers. Absolutely. So let's keep going. We'll talk about this some more. After eating, oh, this is a great, I call it the McDonald's study. And so somebody actually asked me in one of the questions here, can you send in your stool to see your bacteria? Actually, you can. So Britishgut.org, you can get I guess you call it a stool kit. To send in your stool samples, and they kind of crowdsource it. So they take your stool and they see what bacteria is in it and they publish it, not with your name, but they're gathering as many stool samples as possible to really determine what do the microbiomes look like throughout the world. Isn't that interesting? So they're gathering that. So you can go to Britishgut.org and see more about that. But anyways, I want to say this was a study which an N of one. So it was one person, but it was done by a doctor and a microbiologist. So it was very interesting to read this study. And what he did is he actually had a patient, which was his son, eat only fast food from McDonald's for 10 days. And that's all he could eat was McDonald's. And it was interesting. So for the first 3 days, the patient felt okay, but after the third day, he felt really bad. He had no energy, he felt ill. And when they looked at the stool sample, the gut microbiome diversity was devastated by this intake of just fast food McDonald's. The Firmicutes were replaced by Bacteroides, and the bifidobacteria, that's one of the good guys we know about, decreased by over 50%. The patient felt bad. And it took over 2 weeks to get back to gut health, to his baseline gut health. And so, this is just one example, and we hear this repeated in different studies, that when you don't get fresh fruit and vegetables and whole grains, in a very short period of time, this was just 10 days, it can really devastate the microbiome in our intestines. And it does seem that high-fat meals are especially dangerous to us. With diabetes, a high-fat meals appears to trigger passage of bacterial endotoxins through the intestinal wall. So we were talking about those lipopolysaccharide toxins from high-fat foods pass through the intestinal wall and can cause inflammation in the body. And when a person eats high-fat foods, it increases the levels of inflammatory cytokines and triglycerides, contributing to insulin resistance. And it seems to be worse if the person eats frequent fatty foods throughout the day. Here's that term again. This was from Endocrinology News 2011. So this data has really started to accumulate since 2011. But let's take a look at gastric bypass effects on blood glucose. That is true. When we do a Roux-en-Y and we make a smaller gastric pouch and we bypass the duodenum and the food is absorbed in the duodenum, jejunum, and beyond, that when we do that rerouting, for some reason there's an increase in the gut hormones available. And immediately after a gastric bypass, even before the person has lost weight, we will see a decrease in the blood sugars. And we're thinking, oh, it's the gut hormones increasing. But a new article in Endocrine Today said, hey, maybe it's more than that. Physical manipulation of the gut alters the bacterial communities. And what they found when they looked at the bacterial communities is that after a gastric bypass, the levels of Firmicutes Roseburia intestinalis increased. And Roseburia intestinalis, and if I'm not saying that correctly, I apologize, are lacking in people with type 2. So maybe by increasing this particular Firmicutes, it helps to lower blood glucose levels. So as this research continues, we may be finding out that certain bacteria are playing a very significant role in helping our blood sugars or increasing blood sugars. And maybe certain bacteria are really troublesome, like the Helicobacter pylori. When they looked at this study, it's called the SALSA study, they looked at Latinos or 60 years and older, and before they were enrolled in the study, they looked at their blood samples and they found, they looked at H. pylori to see what was their baseline H. pylori. And what they found is that if they did have an H. pylori infection during this 10-year study, they had almost a 3 times more higher risk to develop diabetes if they were seropositive for H. pylori, and it was also associated with higher BMI. So maybe certain bacteria increase inflammation and increase the risk of diabetes, and maybe we can figure out how to treat these. So you're asking me the ultimate question. I know some of you were asking, how do I help improve my bacterial gut health? And I do want to say, as far as probiotics and taking probiotic pills, I don't have any answers for you because it's really difficult to find out accurate information about probiotic pills and which ones are the best, because we don't have good science behind it. That really shows that these probiotics help us or not. So I'm just going to tell you what we do know so far, and I encourage you to do your own research and share with me with whatever you find. But I do want to talk about prebiotics. So we always hear about probiotics. What are prebiotics? Prebiotics are how we feed our good bacteria. We want to feed our good bacteria. We want to keep our good bacteria happy. We want our good bacteria to take up as much real estate as possible in our intestines. It is so important that we share this with, you know, our patients and our communities. How do we support good bacteria? Well, we eat foods that contain indigestible fibers. When we eat foods that contain indigestible fibers, the bacteria break it down in our GI through fermentation. Now, when the bacteria break down energy through fermentation, it usually happens later in the colon. And what's released are these fatty acids. Now, these fatty acids are actually good for our intestine because they help coat the intestinal lining. And that helps that leaky gut syndrome. So high fiber foods, number one. You hear about this all the time, but I can't stress it enough. So much of the foods we eat are processed, so we're not getting the fiber we need a day. It's so basic. It's nothing magical. Fruits, veggies. Here are some of their higher prebiotic foods: Jerusalem artichokes, onions, kale, Brussels sprouts, bananas, berries, nuts. And I have articles on my website of other prebiotics, but those are what we need to eat to feed the good guys. And then we could actually ingest healthy bacteria. And the healthy bacteria are the bifidobacteria and lactobacillus. And as you know, that's found in yogurt and kefir. Look for active cultures. So foods with, you know, that have these cultures in them are healthy for us. And then fermented foods like sauerkraut, kimchi, miso soup, they also contain bacteria. I read one website where it said sourdough bread. So any food that's fermented that they use bacteria is going to help our intestines to better health. How much do you need to eat? We don't know yet. I mean, there's different numbers out there, but there's this whole nutrition called a new nutritional like subdivision, I call it maybe, or I don't know the right word is, but it's called functional nutrition. It's been around for a long time, but it's kind of more entering our common language. And functional nutrition is saying, how can we actively, eat foods that will improve our health? And that's really, really exciting. And from the American Diabetes Association, here's 10 superfoods to enjoy. And during all of my classes, I share with patients these 10 superfoods. So these superfoods, for most of them, are high in fiber and micronutrients. And here we have one that contains, bacteria. And there's been a lot of great research that kids who eat bacteria, kids who eat yogurt, have lower risk of diabetes. So, really kind of considering that as we teach our patients and share with our communities. I definitely tell people move toward the tomato. See, these are processed junk foods that don't support a healthy microbiome, where these foods do. Now I have coffee in here. Coffee isn't necessarily good for our microbiome, but there was some research that came out that I'm drinking 1 to 2 cups of coffee a day. Not the sugar caramel macchiato, but just regular black coffee, does decrease risk of diabetes. So that's kind of our summary of the gut bacteria and how it influences health. And let's move on now to type 1 diabetes and some exciting research in prevention. And here's some people that you might know who have type 1 diabetes. Mary Tyler Moore, type 1 for many years since she was in her 30s, and she's in her 70s now. And she's really entered a struggle time with her diabetes and her eyesight. Nick Jonas, type 1 diabetes, he's rocking it. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, amazing woman, type 1 diabetes since the age of 8, and look what she's been able to accomplish. And of course, Bret Michaels, very open about trying to balance his life as a rock star and someone with type 1 diabetes. So, type 1 diabetes, there's a lot of people out there living with it and really just achieving amazing things. Here's Miss Idaho. I don't know if you saw this picture, but it's just worth mentioning. She has type 1, is on an insulin pump, and she wore in the bathing suit contest, she's like, here I am with my type 1 diabetes. And that was so great that she just shared it, and it really gave permission for a lot of our type 1 kids and adults to say, yeah, this is cool. I mean, having type 1 diabetes doesn't stop me from doing anything. Here's Miss America, 1998, type 1, Nicole Johnson, recently earned her PhD in public health and is really talking a lot about diabetes prevention. She started a DLife, a cable program talking about diabetes. So a lot of amazing stuff happening out there. And I just like to take a look at the natural history of type 1. And so a child is born, and let's say he has a genetic predisposition. Maybe his parents have type 1 or they have autoimmune diseases, and this puts the child at risk for type 1 during their lifetime. And so then, as the child goes on to autoimmunity and his pancreas is being attacked by autoimmune forces, we could look at his blood and we could see the appearance of multiple anti-islet autoantibodies. So as the pancreas is being destroyed, we can measure that it's an autoimmune attack by looking at the blood. And what we look for are these autoantibodies. And the three most common ones we can see that identify that the body, the pancreas is under attack is the GAD, glutamic acid decarboxylase. We'll look for ICA or IAA. Those are the three that we'll usually test for. We have to draw the patient's blood, we send it out, and then a few days later it comes back. Yes, it's positive, or no, it's negative. But even if they have one or more positive, we know they have more of an autoimmune condition. In the labs and the research studies, they're using the ZNT8, a very accurate predictor of type 1 diabetes. But in the communities, in our communities, we usually just use these top three. So I do have to throw this in because a Stanford researcher, this is really exciting, is working on a microchip that would help make the diagnosis of type 1 easy and reliable. So this little microchip, like it would be like a glucose meter. You'd put the blood sample in it, and it would tell you within minutes if those autoantibodies are positive or not. There's so many times, especially since a lot of our Kids coming in with diabetes, new diabetes, are overweight. We don't know if they're type 1 or type 2. So we'd like to have an easy test that's cheap to measure that accurately. And actually, what we think is that we misdiagnose about 10% of adults. We call them type 2s, and they're really type 1. I'm sure you've met those patients. So hopefully in the next few years, we'll have that test available to validate type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And the Stanford researchers actually started a company, so you can check that out. So I'd just like to dispel some of our common understandings of type 1 diabetes. Usually, when I used to teach about type 1, I would say, well, it's complete destruction of the beta cells. But that's maybe not true. Let's go over this. There's a honeymoon phase, and that when somebody with type 1 is diagnosed, 15 to 40% of beta cell function still remains. That honeymoon varies the length of time. But we do know something, that 10 to 15% of teens and adults still have clinically significant insulin production 5 years after diabetes onset. So we used to think, well, by 5 years, zero. That's not true. We're actually seeing that even after 5 years, they have some beta cell functionality. Rate of beta cell loss is correlated with age. The earlier you get it, the more destructive it is. The later you get it, you may not destroy as quickly, and younger patients tend to have shorter honeymoons. So here's the deal, and this is where the research is going, which is so exciting. The remaining beta cells are very important. Even if you only have 10 or 15% left, they can serve one very well while they last, because you know why? They really help to prevent glucose excursions, high blood sugars, low blood sugars, and having more pancreatic beta cells actually helps prevent severe hypoglycemia. So what I'm trying to say is there a way that when you're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you can preserve the remaining beta cells? And this, I'll come to that in a minute, but I do want to say, as you know, Joslin Diabetes Center has It was one of the pioneers in diabetes care. And so they follow people with type 1 diabetes, and they're doing this huge study. And what they have found is that after 50 years with type 1 diabetes, many still produced insulin and many had no eye disease. So this was really shocking because we thought they would have zero. But no, they are still producing some. Not everyone, but those who still produce some have less complications. And I do want to say something before I move on. If you do work with patients with type 1 and they've had diabetes for 25 years or greater, they can get a medal from the Joslin Diabetes Center to recognize all the hard work associated with diabetes. So you can just Google Joslin Diabetes Center to get a medal. It's really cool. So let's just ask you another question about type 1. Which statement is true about type 1 diabetes? All experience complete beta cell destruction? A, B, in some beta cells persist. C, 90% of type 1s get celiac disease. Or D, inform patients and families about TrialNet study. So more than one can be correct. Okay. Thank you guys. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share this with you. So you all right. B, in some beta cells persist. That is absolutely correct. C is not right. 90% of type 1s don't get celiac disease. It's more around, I would say 5%. Some studies say 10%. So most people don't get celiac disease if they have type 1, but there is an increased risk. But D is also a correct answer. You want to inform patients and families about TrialNet if they've been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and I'll get to that in a minute. TrialNet, actually, I'll talk about it right now, is a study that looks at newly diagnosed with type 1 or relatives of people with type 1 diabetes. And what they're trying to do is a few things. They're looking at the natural history of type 1. And they're looking to see, can we prevent type 1 in those at genetic risk, the relatives of somebody with type 1? And then the other question they're asking is, can we provide a medication to somebody who's early diagnosis of type 1 to protect the beta cells. That's the intervention part. And then they're looking at a cure too. But we do know, if you look at primary prevention, what does trigger type 1 diabetes? Some viruses we know are guilty. You have the genetic risk, you get infected, you express type 1. Infants who are not breastfed have a higher risk. Maybe early exposure to some foods increase the risk. And then maybe we're just too clean. So let's take a look at all of these. 1 million people are currently at risk for type 1 diabetes. We can identify them clearly now through genetic testing. And what we're trying to do is see if there's anything we could do to protect people with risk of type 1 from having that beta cell destruction. So the first study I'd like to talk about is the TEDDY trial. The TEDDY trial is looking to see, can we reduce the risk of type 1 diabetes in those at risk if we try different things? Like they have a group who's avoiding early cow's milk exposure. Another group, if they avoid gluten grain exposure before 6 months, is it vitamin D? Is it nitrate? They're trying to look at all these different things. But I did find when I was researching this that in Finland, the Findia pilot study looked at in little babies before the age of, well, I think 6 months, if they did two groups. One was received bovine insulin-free cow's milk formula to see if that versus breast milk, or if that increases the risk of diabetes type 1. So what they found is that when they used the bovine insulin-free cow's milk formula, there was a lower risk of type 1 diabetes conversion. So cow's milk-based formulas, in English, cow's milk-based formulas do seem to increase the risk of diabetes type 1, because in the cow's milk there's this insulin molecule that might actually stimulate hyperaggression toward our body's own insulin. So I would say one message from this study is really avoiding any cow's milk-based formula for children at risk of type 1 diabetes. And of course, breastfeeding is always best. So as far as the TEDDY study, just to kind of wrap up with that, the results aren't there yet. It's a long-term study. But Dr. Hagopian, who's involved in the TEDDY study, says it does. This TEDDY study that we've learned a lot about how to determine who's at risk for diabetes type 1 really has helped us understand an appropriate health model where maybe we can start screening the general population for type 1 in the future. It might be cost-effective. So when I was talking about what's causing this increased risk of type 1 and other autoimmune diseases, we definitely are concerned about hygiene, and not that we're not hygienic enough, that we're over-hygienic. And in one study, they found that mice who were raised in a clean environment had a higher risk for diabetes than ones raised in a dirty environment. In other words, clean living may increase our risk for autoimmune diseases. And again, it has to do with that symbiotic relationship between humans and bacteria, that we need the bacteria to help support our immune system. Risk is higher for type 1 diabetes in urban versus rural settings, and kids who go to daycare and live in farms have lower risk of diabetes. So what is our take-home message? Get dirty, breastfeed if possible, avoid early exposure to cow's milk and cow's milk-based formula, and maybe gluten for those at high risk of type 1 diabetes. The other thing as far as prevention is, if you have the genetic risk for type 1 diabetes, we know that certain viruses can trigger the onset of type 1. So a Finnish team has determined a vaccine to the Coxsackie virus. So Coxsackie virus is one of the viruses when a person with type 1 diabetes at risk is exposed to Coxsackie, it can actually increase the risk of their expression of the type 1. So maybe if we could determine who's at risk for type 1 and give them Coxsackie vaccine, we could prevent the onset of type 1. So this research is so exciting. Here's the information on TrialNet. And the other day I was teaching a class, and a gentleman came up to me and he goes, "My friend's son just got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you know." And I go, "Oh my gosh, you've got to call TrialNet and let them know right away, because there's a very small window, like within 3 months of diagnosis, where they can enroll him in an intervention trial." And so he actually contacted them, and they got him right away into an intervention trial to maybe stop the destruction of the beta cells of the pancreas. And so if you know anyone with type 1 diabetes, newly diagnosed, or family members with type 1 diabetes, this TrialNet is so important. And you don't have to show up to a site. They'll mail the information to you. And I've listed here who's eligible to be a part of the TrialNet study. And they will keep, in touch with anyone who's enrolled over time to see if they become antibody positive and are walking toward type 1 diabetes. And it's all free. It's a free trial. Part of the TrialNet study is that they found that maybe there's certain medications we can provide for children with new onset type 1 within 8 weeks. This was a CD3 medication, teplizumab, and they put them on this medication, within 8 weeks of diagnosis. And what they found is that half of the participants who took the CD3 medication maintained insulin production. Wow, that is really promising. If I have new type 1 and I can preserve some of my beta cells and they can last longer, it really does preserve and improve overall health outcomes. The other really exciting thing is the oral insulin study. What they're doing now is putting people at risk for type 1 diabetes on oral insulin, or if they are antibody positive, and it seems to delay the onset by 4 years, and it also seems to calm down the immune system so it doesn't attack the pancreas. So, I don't know, there's so many exciting things happening out there now. So that kind of concludes our presentation. I wanted to say that as a diabetes educator, I love coming to your town and presenting. And here's a group I have. Every time I teach classes, we get up and we do a diabetes flash mob. So here's a group I was teaching the flash mob to. So I would love an invitation to come teach. I would love for you to join us, our boot camp for those preparing to take the CDE exam, or come join us in San Diego. We have a 3-day course. It's a beautiful site for if you want to review on diabetes or if you're thinking about taking the exam. And I'm so excited you joined me today because I really believe this quote from Margaret Mead, and that is, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And all of us working together can raise awareness about these different factors, environmental factors, food factors, that can help slow down and prevent the epidemic of diabetes. And through all of our collective voices, we can make a big difference. So I'm going to press the stop recording button, but I will hang around for questions if you have any lingering questions. And this is recorded and will be available on our online university and also on our website. So thank you so much for joining us. I will turn off the recording button and join you live in a few seconds. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.